New heading. Why an eighth habit? The world has profoundly changed since The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People was published in 1989. The challenges and complexity we face in our personal lives and relationships, in our families, in our professional lives, and in our organizations are of a different order of magnitude. In fact, many mark 1989, the year we witnessed the fall of the Berlin Wall, as the beginning of the information age, the birth of a new reality, a sea change of incredible significance, truly a new era. Many have asked whether the seven habits are still relevant in today's new reality. My answer is always the same. The greater the change and the more difficult the challenges, the more relevant they become. You see, the seven habits are about becoming highly effective. They represent a complete framework of universal, timeless principles of character and human effectiveness. In short, principles never change. They are universal. They apply everywhere. They are timeless. And they are essentially self-evident, such as, you can never sustain trust without trustworthiness. That is a self-evident principle. But being effective as individuals and organizations is no longer optional in today's highly competitive world. It is simply the price of entry to the playing field. But surviving, thriving, innovating, excelling, and leading in this new reality will require us to build on and reach beyond effectiveness. The call and need of a new era is for greatness. It's for fulfillment, passionate execution, and significant contribution. These are on a different plane or dimension. They are different in kind. Just as significance is different in kind, not in degree, from success. Tapping into the higher reaches of human genius and motivation, what we could call voice, requires a new mindset, a new skill set, a new tool set, a new habit. The eighth habit, then, is not about adding one more habit to the seven, one that somehow got forgotten. It's about seeing and harnessing the power of a third dimension to the seven habits that meets the central challenge of the new knowledge worker age. This eighth habit is find your voice and inspire others to find theirs. The eighth habit represents the pathway to the enormously promising side of today's reality. It stands in stark contrast to the pain and frustration of the voices I've been describing. In fact, it is a timeless reality. It is the voice of the human spirit, full of hope and intelligence, resilient by nature, boundless in its potential to serve the common good. This voice also encompasses the soul of organizations that will survive and thrive and profoundly impact the future of the world. In your mind's eye, try to envision, to imagine four overlapping circles. The nexus, or the intersection area, representing voice, one's unique personal significance. These are the four circles that overlap. Talent, what you're good at. Passion, what you love doing. Conscience, what you feel is right, what you should be doing. And need. Need is the area where there is pain, where there is hurt, where there is a place to add value in all parts of society. Talent, passion, conscience, and need. Overlapping. The intersection area is voice, one's unique personal significance. Voice is exactly that, unique, personal significance. Significance that is revealed as we face our greatest challenges and which makes us equal to them. As I've mentioned, voice lies at the nexus of talent, your natural gifts and strengths, passion, those things that naturally energize, excite, motivate, and inspire you. Need, including what the world needs enough to pay you for, that can drive your economic engine. And conscience, that still small voice within, that assures you of what is right and what prompts you to actually do it. When you engage in work that taps your talents and fuels your passion, that rises out of a great need in the world that you feel drawn by conscience to meet, therein lies your voice, your calling, your soul's code. There is a deep, innate, almost inexpressible yearning within each one of us to find our own voice in life. The exponential revolutionary explosion of the Internet is one of the most powerful modern manifestations of this truth. The Internet is perhaps the perfect symbol of the new world, of the information knowledge worker economy, and of the dramatic changes that have occurred. In their 1999 book, Clue Train Manifesto, authors Locke, Levine, Searles, and Weinberger put it this way, quote, "All of us are finding our voices again, learning how to talk to one another. Inside, outside, there's a conversation going on today that hasn't happened at all 5 years ago and hasn't been very much in evidence since the Industrial Revolution began. Now, spanning the planet via the Internet and World Wide Web, this conversation is so vast, so multifaceted, that trying to figure out what it's about is futile. It's about a billion years of pent-up hopes and fears and dreams coated in serpentine double helixes, the collective flashback déjà vu of our strange, perplexing species. Something ancient, elemental, sacred, something very, very funny that's broken loose in the pipes and wires of the 21st century. There are millions and millions of threads in this conversation, but at the beginning and end of each one is a human being. This fervid desire for the web bespeaks a longing so intense that it can only be understood as spiritual. A longing indicates something is missing in our lives. What is missing is the sound of the human voice. The spiritual lure of the web is the promise of the return of voice." Close quote. Rather than further describe voice, let me illustrate it through the true story of one man. When I met Muhammad Yunus, founder of the Grameen Bank, a unique organization established for the sole purpose of extending microcredit to the poorest of the poor, I asked him when and how he had gained his vision. He said he didn't have any vision to begin with at all. He simply saw someone in need and tried to fill it, and the vision evolved. Muhammad Yunus's vision of a poverty-free world was set in motion with a little simple event on the streets of Bangladesh. While interviewing him for my syndicated column on leadership, he shared his story with me. Listen to his words. "It all started 25 years ago. I was teaching economics at a university in Bangladesh. The country was in the middle of a famine. I felt terrible. Here I was, teaching the elegant theories of economics in the classroom with all the enthusiasm of a brand new PhD from the United States. But I would walk out of the classroom and see skeletons all around me, people waiting to die. I felt that whatever I had learned, whatever I was teaching, was all make-believe stories with no meaning for people's lives. So I started trying to find out how people lived in the village next door to the university campus. I wanted to find out whether there was anything I could do as a human being to delay or to stop the death, even for one single person. I abandoned the bird's-eye view that lets you see everything from above, from the sky. I assumed a worm's-eye view, trying to find whatever comes right in front of you. Smell it. Touch it. See if you can do something about it. One particular incident took me in a new direction. I met a woman who was making bamboo stools. After a long discussion, I found out that she made only 2 US pennies each day. I couldn't believe anybody could work so hard and make such beautiful bamboo stools, yet make such a tiny amount of profit. She explained to me that because she didn't have the money to buy the bamboo to make the stools, she had to borrow from the trader. And the trader imposed the condition that she had to sell the product to him alone, at a price that he decided. And that explains the 2 pennies. She was virtually in bonded labor to this person. And how much did the bamboo cost? She said, "Oh, about 20 cents. For a very good one, 25 cents. I thought, people suffer for 20 cents and there is nothing anyone can do about it? I debated whether I should give her 20 cents. But then I came up with another idea. Let me make a list of people who needed that kind of money. I took a student of mine and we went around the village for several days and came up with a list of 42 such people. When I added up the total amount they needed, I got the biggest shock of my life. It added up to $27. I felt ashamed of myself for being part of a society which could not provide even $27 to 42 hardworking, skilled human beings. To escape that shame, I took the money out of my pocket and gave it to my student and said, "You take this money and give it to those 42 people that we met and tell them this is a loan, but they can pay me back whenever they are able to. In the meantime, they can sell their products wherever they can get a good price." After receiving the money, they were very excited, and seeing that excitement made me think, what do I do now? I thought of the branch bank, which was located on the campus of the university, and I went to the manager and suggested that he lend money to the poor people that I had met in the village. He fell from the sky. He said, "You are crazy. It's impossible. How could we lend money to poor people? They are not creditworthy." I pleaded with him and said, "At least give it a try. Find out. It's only a small amount of money." He said, "No. Our rules don't permit it. They cannot offer collateral, and such a tiny amount is not worth lending." He suggested that I see the high officials in the banking hierarchy in Bangladesh. I took his advice, and I went to the people who matter in the banking section. Everyone told me the same thing. Finally, after several days of running around, I offered myself as a guarantor. I'll guarantee the loan. I'll sign whatever they want me to sign, and they can give me the money, and I'll give it to the people that I want to. So that was the beginning. They warned me repeatedly that the poor people who receive the money will never pay it back. I said, "I'll take a chance." And the surprising thing was, they repaid me every penny. I got very excited and came to the manager and said, "Look, they pay back. There's no problem." But he said, "Oh no, they're just fooling you. Soon they will take more money and never pay you back." So I gave them more money, and they paid me back. I told this to the manager again, but he said, "Well, maybe you can do it in one village, but if you do it in 2 villages, it won't work." And I hurriedly did it in 2 villages, and it worked. So it became a kind of struggle between me and the bank manager and his colleagues in the highest positions. They kept saying that a larger number, 5 villages probably, will show it. So I did it in 5 villages, and it only showed that everybody paid back. Still they didn't give up. They said 10 villages, 50 villages, 100 villages. And so it became a kind of contest between them and me. I came up with results that they could not deny because it was their money that I was giving. But they would not accept it because they are trained to believe that poor people are not reliable. Luckily, I was not trained that way, so I could believe whatever I was seeing as it revealed itself. But the bankers' minds, their eyes were blinded by the knowledge they had. Finally, I had the thought, why am I trying to convince them? I am totally convinced that poor people can take money and pay it back. Why don't we set up a separate bank? That excited me, and I wrote down the proposal and went to the government to get the permission to set up a bank. It took me 2 years to convince the government. On October 2nd, 1983, we became a bank, a formal, independent bank. And what excitement for all of us, now that we had our own bank and we could expand as we wished, and expand we did. Each year, they lend about $500 million. They lend even to beggars to help them come out of begging and start selling. Grameen Bank now works in more than 46,000 villages in Bangladesh through 1,267 branches with over 12,000 staff members. They have lent more than $4.5 billion in loans of $12 to $15, averaging under $200. A housing loan is $300. These are small numbers to those of us in business, but think in terms of the individual impact. To lend $500 million annually required 3.7 million people, 96% of whom are women, to make a decision that they could and would take steps to change their lives and the lives of their families. 3.7 million people had to decide that they were capable of creating change. 3.7 million people survived the sleepless night to show up trembling but committed at the Grameen office the next morning. At the heart of this empowerment lies individual women who chose individually and in synergistic, norm-producing groups to become self-reliant, independent entrepreneurs producing goods out of their own homes or neighborhoods or backyards to become economically viable and successful. They found their voice. The overlapping of passion, talent, to meet need as driven by conscience. As I have studied and interviewed some of the world's great leaders, I notice that their sense of vision and voice has usually evolved slowly. I am sure there are exceptions. Some may have a vision of what is possible suddenly burst upon their consciousness. But generally speaking, I find that vision comes as people sense human need and respond to their conscience in trying to meet that need. And when they meet that need, they see another and meet that, and on. Little by little, they begin to generalize a sense of need and start thinking of ways to institutionalize their efforts so that they can be sustained. This taps deeply into their talents and into their passion. Muhammad Yunus is an example of a man who did exactly that, sensed human need and responded to conscience by applying his talent and passion to meet that need, first personally, then in building trust and searching for creative solutions to problems, and finally by institutionalizing the capacity to fill the needs of society through an organization. He found his voice in inspiring others to find theirs. Again, he found his voice in inspiring others to find theirs. the microcredit, sometimes called microfinancing movement, is now spreading across the entire world. Mother Teresa once said, "Few of us can do great things, but all of us can do small things with great love."